Let's roll. This is Countercharge, your podcast for all things Kings of War. Join your hosts Rob Fanoff and Mark Zielinski as they delve into the world of Mantica and bring you in-depth coverage of all things Kings of War.
Welcome to Countercharge, gentle listener. I'm Dan Reed.
I'm Nick Williams.
And I'm Mark Zielinski. Welcome to the third episode of the Narrative Workshop. We're very, very excited today. And, of course, one of the reasons we're so excited is because tonight we're joined by Nick Williams here in the workshop. Nick is going to be helping us explore running narrative campaigns in Kings of War and discussing his new brainchild for the game as well, which personally I think could be knitted into its own campaign, but we'll discuss that a little bit later on. But tonight, our tour guide is Daniel Reed. So without further ado, Daniel, are you ready to start our journey into the narrative workshop?
It will be my humongous pleasure.
All right, and away we go.
So, campaigns. Why play them? It seems to be something that some people do and some people don't do. I've got a few talking points about why you would want to play a campaign. And number one is that some gamers just like to play with what they've got, or they may be restricted with what they've got, and they can't do a lot of army building. They're not necessarily into list building as a thing. They're more in the line of getting some troops on the table, pushing them about, and having a bit of a laugh. So, to a certain extent, the competitive side of a game might not be something that they can participate in. And being part of a campaign, even though you may end up losing every game, provides some compensations in terms of narrative and fun that might make up for some of that. Number two, we're playing fantasy war games for the most part, and most of us will have been attracted to the fantasy war game by the stories, the artwork, the genre, the spiky clubs, the bows, the monsters, that sort of thing. And we may have got there via maybe having an interest in history and historical battles, or we may have watched Lord of the Rings or read it, things like that. And we may just feel that we need to recreate that in our war game, in which case there's a hell of a lot that you need to do beyond playing the rules in order to create an atmosphere and create a story behind your games. Leading on from that, of course, we're all essentially what's the word? How can I put this diplomatically? We are grown-up children playing with toys at the end of the day. And some people like to name their toys and give them little backstories and have an overall ongoing narrative about what they've done and what they're going to do. And playing in a campaign really allows you to make the most of that. And the other thing is that if you're playing in a campaign, the games might not necessarily be incredibly competitive. They might not be terribly balanced, and so you can have all kinds of weird and wonderful things happening as a result, which you can then turn into the story of your faction or your campaign. But anyway, that's my starting point for campaigns. I don't know if anyone wants to talk about any of those.
Well, the one thing that comes to mind when you're talking about that is back when we were children, or maybe even currently, when you have your little figures running across the battle going pew, 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 or hitting them and knocking them down. We all kind of started that way a little bit. I see my, when my nieces and nephews were younger, you know, they take their Playmobil figures and knock the knights together. And it's like, basically, war games are just that with dice added. And that's actually how I got them and my children started into war games. It's like, wouldn't you like to know which knight won as opposed to click, click, click when you're putting them together? And that's kind of where we all kind of start as narrative war gamers a little bit. So
I started with those little plastic soldiers that you used to get in tubs and, invented names and rules for them, which were, probably a bit rubbish, but the rules weren't the important thing. The important thing was moving these plastic toys around. So, yeah.
Absolutely. So, well, Mantic actually did a book on narrative campaigns or campaigns in general, and actually put their own campaign together, and that was called The Destiny of Kings, which was an awesome book. And so I don't know if you haven't seen it before, it is up on Mantic Digital, and you can download a copy. If you like paper, you can try to track one down. In that book, they have a special thanks to Nick Williams, who is our special guest tonight. So, Nick, how'd you get a special thanks in Destiny of Kings?
Well, there's actually the whole rules committee that are special thanks in there. So it's got me, Matt Gilbert, Dan King, Sammy Mahmood, and Chris Morris, who were the rules committee at the time. But specifically for me, I wrote the narrative scenarios in the Destiny of Kings book.
Now, how exciting is that? So, well, I'm sure Daniel's going to have lots of quizzing for you here in a few
I'm
minutes.
quite
So,
fond of them.
the other thing that's narrative in this book, too, is the background material, and that was written by Greg Smith, and we've had him on the show before, but I haven't heard from Greg in a while. Is he still the lore master for Mantic, or did somebody else pick up that position?
I'm not entirely sure. I know that Rob Berman's been doing a lot of work on the background, and I haven't seen Greg be involved myself. He may be working in the background and just not visible, but I don't think he is the Law Master anymore.
All right, very good. Well, I'll have to follow up with Mr. Berman and pick his brain regarding that. So, but I don't want to hold up the show on that. So, Daniel, why don't you take us on to the deep dive into this book called The Destiny of Kings?
Yeah, well, Destiny of Kings was just what I was looking for, really. And I think it's quite interesting that it did come out not long after second edition dropped. And as we all know, Kings of War can be a very competitive tournament game. So I assumed at the time that Destiny of Kings might have been an attempt to grab more narrative players into the fold and not just go after the people who'd been playing Warhammer tournaments and things like that. Although having said that, with the exception of probably quite a few groups of people around the world, it does seem to have somewhat disappeared off the radar. Possibly because it was so long that it came out and it's been superseded by a bit more excitement about things like Clash of Kings, and Uncharted Empires. So I think it was a really welcome gesture from Mantic to show that, Kings of War could encompass all kinds of things. And my personal opinion on it is that it's such an elegant rule set that you can basically do whatever you like with it. It's a framework. You can add more to it. You can keep it as it is. You can put it in a competitive setting. You can put it in a narrative setting. I think you can do whatever you like with it. So it was really great to see that coming out.
Well, fortunately, we have Nick here. So, Nick, does that kind of jive with what was actually behind the scenes when Destiny of Kings was kind of put together? Was that kind of the thought for Mantic?
Yeah, absolutely. As Daniel said, Kings of War is a really great framework to expand on and well, obviously play out the boxes as well as expand upon it with your own rules. And this was definitely a supplement aiming at grabbing the more narrative players. I think there's definitely swings and roundabouts in terms of releases that Mantic do. They will do some competitive releases, and I think we're moving to a phase now where we're going to see more narrative releases in the immediate future.
Now that is very, very exciting. So,
Yes.
well, see, and that's why we thought we'd swing back to Destiny of Kings. So, Daniel, I see you have a note down here about different types of campaigns that are in the book.
Yes. The book has two lots of campaigns. There is a sort of narrative scenario which involves a sequential sequence of battles that are played, in which each battle and the outcome of each battle will affect the next one. In an ongoing narrative, which is, I believe, Mortebris trying to take over the world. And it even incorporates some of Dungeon Saga, a particular scenario with Dungeon Saga, getting those players involved, which is a very early attempt, I think, at something that Vanguard is going to do when it comes out next year, which is to sort of incorporate different play systems into your overall Kings of War narrative, which us narrative players have waxed on about at length in previous podcasts. How excited we are for Vanguard and the possibilities it's going to bring. So the other version of a campaign, which is a map-based campaign, which is run by an organizer and may have anything from 2 to 5 to 6 to even 8 players. I think I had 8 players in my campaign at one point, which was interesting, which is organized by an organizer and involves things like armies moving around a map, taking territory, encountering enemies, and usually works towards having an overall winner. Who will, conquer the world that you've chosen to be in, and be the overall victor of everything. And these two do play quite differently. I have primarily experience with the second, which is the map-based campaign, although I have played some of the scenarios in the narrative campaign.
Very nice. Now, the book had certain different mechanics and things like that that were in there, so that I think were a little more universal before you got into each different type
there
of
were
campaign.
A few things which were quite interesting. There was the idea of the Endless Tide, which creates a nice narrative for your games, as seen in lots of fictional settings, which is the plucky defenders holding out against a huge horde of horrible gribbly monsters or orcs or whatever it happens to be coming over the horizon, who seem to be never ending. Battle of Helm's Deep in Lord of the Rings is perhaps a good example of that, in which the enemy units, as soon as you kill them, are recycled on the edge of the table and are coming on again. And this gets quite a lot of people quite anxious when you explain this mechanic to them, because they think this means that it's going to be impossible for them to win any particular battle. However, the victory conditions that Nick created in his unequal scenarios means that that's not always the case. Something else would be the organizing the defenses rule, where the defender in many scenarios gets to allocate the terrain and gets access to lots of special terrain of a defensive nature, which will greatly impede the attacker's advance and generally help with the victory conditions, and making it a little bit more equalized, because you would think that if you've got 40 million orcs charging at you over a level playing field, that you are going to die. And that allows for you to have a little bit of defense and fortification. The other thing that they have for map campaigns is advancement, which is at the end of any particular game, you would roll for your forces to find out who's been killed, what units have been completely devastated, whether your general has been sniped by a lucky cannonball. And then those units that aren't dead get to make advances on various tables and things in order to see whether they get veteran status and stuff like that. Clash of Kings had one version of doing that. There was another version that Clash of Kings 17 came out with, which was slightly more tailored and intensive, and which we adopted in our campaign eventually.
Oh, very nice. I like the experience system for units and things like that. So very, very interesting.
Well, Clash of Kings had tables for specific troop types that were tailored around that. So, for example, war machines could get very specific rules that were very related to war machines. Characters would get character-based rules that they could acquire, whereas the one in Destiny of Kings was a bit more overall. So a war machine might get a rule that didn't quite apply to it. It was create your own stuff, really. I mean, you make up your own house rules as you go along with a map-based campaign.
I'm looking forward to Clash of Kings 2018 to see what kind of narrative little gribblies are in there. We'll be talking about those later. So very, very excited about that.
Now, I hate to jump on
no,
your
jump on. Go ahead. Burst my bubble. Burst my bubble,
Burst your
Nick.
Bubble a little bit, but I don't think there's actually the narrative bits in Clash of Kings 18. I may be wrong on that, but I don't want people to have the hopes up for more narrative stuff in Clash of Kings 18. I think it is mostly the competitive side in Clash of Kings.
Ah, but there is the thing that's coming out alongside the Clash of Kings.
Oh, yes, there's that as well.
The other thing I have to mention is Clash of Kings 2017 is still available in Mantic Digital. So even after they stop selling it in the store, hopefully, listen to this, Ronnie, you will still be able to pick up Clash of Kings 2017, because there is some great stuff in that book that you wrote, Nick. I mean, in particular, like designing your own units type of stuff and all that. Fantastic resource.
Oh, thank you very much.
I hope that resource never goes away. And that really plays into this narrative thing with doing campaigns too, is designing your own units and things like that. You know, that kind of fit, for those models that, you have that you love, but you really can't use in a competitive game, you can certainly use them in the narrative.
Yeah, that I completely agree with everything you said. And I do think that the various, I guess you'd call them articles that are in the Clash of Kings 17 book, they should certainly be made available somehow, because they are such a good resource. Not to to big myself up too much or anything there, but the guidelines on creating your own units and stuff, I definitely think that should be made available going forward.
No, absolutely. I agree. I think that what we said earlier about Kings of War, the rule set being an elegant framework, means that you can have all these supplements, and I think they should always be available to just add on. The only thing we don't have at the moment is a siege supplement, but then there was some contention about whether siege battles are actually worth playing or not.
Yes.
But yeah, it's important to have all these books, because they cater to all kinds of different players, and I think wargamers tend to have a spectrum of what they're into. And on one end of the spectrum, you have people who are in it for purely the mental challenge of something, of digesting a rule set, finding out all the loopholes, playing it competitively. And to them, to a certain extent, I expect there are some players out there for whom playing with cardboard squares and rectangles would be just as much fun as a fully painted army with names and things like that. And then right on the other end of the spectrum, you've got people who are, into naming everybody, painting everything up, creating their own rules, house ruling, making stuff up as they go along. And then everybody else is on that spectrum in between, to a greater or lesser extent. So the more that you can cater to all kinds of people, I think the more successful this game's going to be.
Absolutely, yes. I should also say that people change where they are on the spectrum at different times as well. So in the past, I've been more competitive minded, not to the extent that you said where you're picking up loopholes or anything like that. I would always be mindful of fluff when creating armies and stuff. But this year, I do intend to play more towards the narrative side of things.
That's really interesting, Nick, because I'm kind of edging in the other way, in the other direction. I think that's really interesting what you said, because I've just been thinking about that myself, and thinking how ironic it is that I'm talking about narrative things, and I'm about to participate in a competitive league at my local war games club, and have actually signed up to do the tournament in Bexley Reapers in the summer. But I don't think I'll ever quite abandon my narrative interest in the game.
No, and I don't think anybody would abandon their specific preference, but it's certainly great to expand your horizons and play more towards the other side of what you're used to.
Absolutely. Give it all a try. That's what I say.
There you go. Who's going to be running that league over there for the Bexley Reapers?
Well, that's the Bexley one is the tournament. I think it's being run by, I want to say, Mark Cunningham, but I'm not sure, because I don't actually go to Bexley Reapers, but for a tournament, I could definitely get there. But it's all up on Facebook and everything. The league that I'm in is actually being run by some people who are not necessarily particularly familiar to Kings of War. They had a league last year, which I wasn't a part, which was entirely based on the rules out of the rule book, with one amendment about flyers, the Clash of Kings 17 flyers rule. And so they're sort of catching up now. So the league is actually going to be Clash of Kings 17, rather than 18. So yeah, it's going to be interesting.
Oh, that is exciting. I've actually used leagues, and we did this when I owned my friendly local gaming store. We actually used our leagues as part of our campaign, so which was very interesting. And it was a map-based campaign, actually. This was back in Warhammer days, of course,
Wow.
but back when they had the Albion campaign, I actually did that entire map in little squares. And that's what the league was all about moving your guys around on the map, and then hopefully, and it did work out pretty well. When your guys met in the certain squares, you would have your battle, and that's what the league was all about. We kind of put it all together, and I kind of segueing here a little bit because that's the first type of campaign we're going to dive into a little bit, and that is map-based
Oh,
campaigns.
yes.
A lot of fun. Like I said, I ran them at the store. They were very, very exciting. We would always have the map up on the wall. Everybody had their different units and things like that, and they would go ahead and move around. And we made up some campaign rules. I do have Mighty Empires, but I've never used it and never played it. So it sits downstairs. I got all the pieces, and maybe one day I'll pull that out because that's a random map. But I'm going to turn it over to you, Daniel, and you can take us away here into map-based gameplay.
Okay, well, what I've got here is a few hints and tips on how to run a map-based campaign successfully, which you will also find in quite a lot of them in Destiny of Kings. It's very helpful on that front. And this is just stuff that I've come across as a result of having sort of taken the plunge. I actually used the very recent Mighty Empire set to create our map for that. So what do you need to run one successfully? Well, you need a good group of players, and you need those players to definitely be up for it, who aren't embarrassed to name all their characters, maybe name all their units, who aren't overly into the competitive list building side of the game, but obviously who still would quite like to win their individual battles. I actually had everyone name all their characters and name all their starting territories. And we had quite a lot of hilarious names because, you know, some people will go the whole hog and call their names, you know, use Lord of the Rings, Elven language to create very impressive sounding names. And other people will give them joke names, and that's fine too. People would, but this also gives you leeway. Once you've got a name for a character, he has to live up to his name. Or maybe not live up to his name, and that would be also be interested. People can convert and model their miniatures to fit the fluff that they've created for their armies. We particularly had an Urgar Warlock in the game called Ankh, who was very nifty with a lightning bolt, and so was eventually modeled up with an actual piece of carpet under his foot, which he would use to generate static electricity and create his lightning bolts. And you've got to have players who are willing to kind of go into that and just completely unselfconsciously just have a go at it. Another thing that you need is a certain degree of commitment, at least possibly one game a month, which could possibly be stretched out a bit longer. But you need to keep the impetus up in the campaign because people will get bored and they'll go off and play other games and do other things. But it's normally very difficult as a result to get all the players in the same room at the same time. If that happens in your club, you're quite lucky in my experience. So there will be an element of playing by mail, as in players will send you through their orders, what they want to do with their armies, where they want to go and stuff like that. And then it's up to you as the campaign organizer to work that all out, move the armies on the map, and then get the results back. As a result, a very good tool for doing these things can either be Facebook or some sort of forum or some sort of hub that you can all access. People can post updates, battle results, and in our particular case, completely unprompted fluff about things. People would suddenly be walking around doing their shopping one day and then suddenly have an idea for a story for one of their characters and just post it up on Facebook and get lots of responses. The other thing is you've got to change it up on a regular basis. So, for example, at Christmas, I gave everyone a Christmas reroll, which they had leeway to use in whatever way they wanted up until a certain date. And, of course, rerolls get to determine the results of battles sometimes and make them more interesting. I also let people keep their living legend that they created for the International Campaign Day, which was a character with a combination of artifacts that wasn't necessarily strictly balanced, but which people had taken a lot of time to work out and give names to and things like that. So all that stuff really helps to maintain interest. Another thing that you should do if you're a campaign organizer is you should try and play in the campaign yourself, because, you know, you're running it, you're doing all the hard work, and you're not getting any games in. So, for example, when I did my campaign, I played the big bad, the head honcho, the evil orc overlord who lived in the middle of the map and who all the other players were trying to overthrow. So the object of the campaign was you take over someone else's empire and you instantly become almost top dog. And then the final battle will be you take on the orcs in a multiplayer game. The orcs will recruit the bad players, the good players will recruit the good players, and there will be certain advantages and disadvantages in that game based on how successful you've been. And then during the campaign on a regular basis, if you rolled a one when you moved your army around the map, you got attacked by my orc force. So I managed to get a few games in as well. And then the final thing as a campaign organizer that you really have to be aware of is that players will be, well, for want of a better word, wanting to break the campaign to a certain extent. As in, they will want to know exactly what they can do, exactly what they won't do, what they can't do, and they will ask a hell of a lot of questions, which you may not have the answers for immediately on hand. But the thing you need to do is you just need to talk with your players, work out what the best solution for, I don't know, some sort of loophole. Can my army go backwards? Can I do this? Can I do that? Do my reinforcements arrive here or there or everywhere? You've got to just have a think about it, have a chat, work out what will be best, what would be amenable to everybody. And in the final solution, you roll a dice, and then the solution after that is, well, you're the organizer, you are effectively the dungeon master, you are God, you're in charge, so what you say goes. But don't abuse your power, I would add. Anyway, so that is my list of tips as to not exactly how to run a narrative campaign, I mean a map-based campaign, but certainly some hints and tips. And I would urge you to buy Destiny of Kings if you can, because that will give you the framework to do it.
Those are some really good points, and the last one in particular, I think applies to all narrative campaigns in terms of having almost a dungeon master for running these narrative games, because you will run into instances where actually the rules don't cover a situation, and you need somebody to be able to make a final call. So having a dungeon master equivalent on hand to resolve any conflicts, I think is quite an important thing for narrative gaming.
Yes, absolutely. And I think you also find as being that dungeon master, as you think that certain players might come back and give you a bit of trouble when you make a ruling, but actually most people are just happy to have a ruling on something because they just want to know what the boundaries are and what they can do and what they can't do. So in the final analysis, it all works out fine.
So you touched briefly on the play by email type of gaming with these map campaigns. Did you ever run into any problems where two players should be playing each other? You know, their armies have met and they're meant to have a game or something like that, but because of their time in their schedule, they unfortunately never get round to having that game. How would you go about
Yes.
resolving that?
Yes, that happened quite a few times. Within the boundaries of reason, sometimes I would give them, say, an extra couple of weeks to try and see if they could, schedule it out. But in the event that they couldn't do that, we had a sort of proxy system whereby someone else, if they want playing a game, could proxy in as a mercenary and play that battle for that person who couldn't turn up. With the other person, and they would get certain rewards like certain amounts of treasure or extra artifacts and items and things like that. So that's how we got around that one in the end.
That's a really good system. I like that.
Well, it means people are playing games. You just want to be getting people to play a lot of games. And I used to tease and taunt and kind of try and get people to play other people's games by offering them ridiculous amounts of things like artifacts. And then once they played the game, I went, well, you can only have them for the duration of the next battle. You're not getting them forever. Which I thought was quite cruel, but they appreciated it. We would also have other one-off games that you could do if you didn't play your if you couldn't play your specific campaign battle. You could do things like we had, I forget what we called them now, but you could play a one-off game for the purposes of seeing if you could get another artifact. So it wouldn't gain you any territory, but it might have gained you the Brew of Sharpness or something like that, which might be useful. And it would also gain you experience with your units. But of course, the drawback to that was you risk your army in the post-battle phase, so it's a bit of an adventure.
So I love the fact that you have that little DM quality to it, your map-based campaigns, because that's what I did. I also played the neutral army, which was great. And my other solution too, for when another player wouldn't show up and I couldn't, you know, if I could play that game, I would play that game. So, you know, with my army or something like that, as opposed to, if I couldn't get another player, I would always step in. And I feel that's kind of the role of the organizer to kind of keep things moving and stuff like that. So, and, you know, if you can't make it, you know, you kind of accept that results. And the way I think about that is like when a player doesn't show up to his D&D game and you're in the dungeon and sometimes you die. It's just the way life goes. You should show up.
Yes, that's true. It's a bit like in the tournament. They call it the ringer, don't they? The army that the organizer has that can sub in for people who don't turn up or whatever. But yeah, you've
Yes.
got to accept the consequences of not turning up.
And Absolutely. Now, the next type of campaign that's mentioned in the Destiny of Kings book is narrative campaigns. So why don't you go ahead and take us through that, Dan?
Sure. Well, I have less experience of running or going through a full narrative campaign. The one in Destiny of Kings is quite a few scenarios, and I have found in the past that I can't quite complete them all because you'd like to do it with the same people week after week so that you get a bit of continuity going, and that isn't always possible. Well, what I did do relatively recently was run a little we had an open day at the club, and I ran the first three scenarios from the Destiny of Kings narrative campaign, and it worked out pretty well, actually. The players were initially apprehensive about it because the scenarios from the start are incredibly unequal. The baddies tend to outnumber the goodies. And in one of the particular scenarios, I think it might have been the second or the third, there is absolutely no terrain on the board whatsoever, except for a castle on the edge of the board, which the defenders are standing in front of. If you've played competitive Kings of War or competitive Warhammer or whatever, this is slightly worrying when you come across it. And I did have quite a lot of apprehension for those people who were going to participate. But actually, once they got into it, they enjoyed themselves immensely. And actually found that the swings and the highs and the lows of unequal scenarios really possibly just added an extra element of fun. So I was looking at that and thinking, this could be done possibly on a regular basis. There could even be, I mean, we ended up actually with some prize support because the club had been given the prize support. And so actually the people who won the campaign ended up winning it, and in the same way that they would have a tournament. I think that's possibly a good format that could, with a few tweaks, be rolled out generally. The one in Destiny of Kings book also involves the Dungeon Saga scenario, which is very interesting. Well, I haven't actually done that one, but I always intend to one day. And the other thing that is quite interesting about the narrative scenarios is people think that they have to use the same armies that are in the book. You don't. You can transplant whatever armies you've got with absolutely no problem whatsoever. So I do recommend it. The only drawback of that is that you might not be able to have the continuity of playing them all in sequence all the way through with the same people.
Now, Nick, do you have any experience just with narrative campaigns?
I don't, unfortunately. It's not something that I've played in the past. I certainly weighed in on the narrative campaigns in the books to make sure that the mechanics work. But unfortunately, it's not something that I've played much myself. But again, with my intention to play more narrative games over the next year, that's going to be something that I'm going to be looking at.
Now, for me, this is my primary mode of campaign play. So Colin is the ultimate narrative gamer, particularly when it comes to campaigns. And again, I'm going to reference Warhammer, and we've done a couple for Kings of War, actually. But, you know, a lot of it generated from him from Sigmar's Blood at the beginning of the End Times. So this is not that old, so that he really got into this. But he loved those books, and this is why I want fluff from Mantic and the version of novels and things like that. So he wanted to recreate those battles, okay? So he put that together. He took the map out of the book, and I blew it up for him and in color, and he put little map points and everything in there, and he looked at all the armies, and he put everything together, and he put everything together and said, "Dad, I'm ready to play." And I'd come down and say, "What are we doing?" And he'd spin the entire tale around why we're here, and this is a campsite, and you're in here attacking my guys. And he was basically playing one part of the narrative campaign, and I was the other players, the neutral players in his story. And he was getting the most enjoyment out of it from the end standpoint. For me, I was having a blast playing with my son. So this is a great way to play with kids, particularly if they're really into the fluff. And we would have these battles all the time. And, you know, based on who won or who lost, he decided what happened next based on the narrative campaign and stuff like that. And then every time we'd have a battle, he'd write little stories after it and the whole nine yards. And he created that character Colin von Karstein, who to this day has moved from the Warhammer world to Mantica and is running around. So we actually took a narrative campaign spin to International Campaign Day, where we created armies, named them, named our hero that we created, that living legend, and then that army could not change as we played the different games through it. And every time he would write a little story afterwards. So, and just have a blast with it. So if you're really into it, creative writing, or, you know, if you're looking to design a story for Kings of War or something, these narrative campaign games can really provide you the grist for the mill, so to speak, to get your creative juices flowing and write those stories and things like that. We had a blast. And a lot of it is, you know, comes from naming your guys and just, you know, like, okay, here's the next thing. And the thing I liked about International Campaign Day is they always had these wacky scenarios that really helped add the flavor to it. And you could really just see yourself and spin the tale around it on why you were here. So it was a lot of fun. We had a blast. So I love narrative campaigns. They're you know, we try to build competitive, equally balanced armies most of the time. And it's just trying to find that scenario that's going to work. And, you know, I've used the Warhammer 40K open play cards a little bit for that too. So, but Nick has come up with a better solution, and we're going to talk about that after the commercial break. But very, very nice. So I love narrative campaigns.
I love the idea of that, Mark, not, you know, turning up and just not knowing what's in store for you and just having to react and adapt to whatever Colin had in store for you. I think that's great. You know, it's just like playing D&D in a way, isn't it? You can't really pre-plan. You know, the Dungeon Master has it all worked out and you've just got to react and do your best. And that's where all the fun stuff happens.
Yeah, you know, it was kind of weird being kind of in reverse. He was the DM putting together for his party, and then I was playing the monsters, so to speak. You know what I mean? As opposed to the DM controlling the monsters weren't controlled by him. He was spinning the tale for his party, and I was just playing the bad guys.
That's an awesome reverse. Of course, the main mechanism to play narrative campaigns is that whatever you do in the first battle will affect what you get to do in the second battle, and, you know, victory conditions in the second battle will affect the third battle, and so on and so forth. I have a question for Nick, which is, if you were inventing a narrative campaign such as that, would you be concerned that the consequences of either the first or the second battle be balanced, or would you go for a sort of fluffy flavor of anything could happen?
Ooh, that's a good question. I'm not entirely sure. On one hand, I would want to make things balanced. On the other hand, yeah, the point of narrative campaigns is to have a little bit of unbalance. I would certainly not want it to go as far as any balance being impossible to overcome. So I think that there should always be an objective that a player can win. So even if you've got those narrative scenarios where you've got the enemy's reinforcements coming on constantly, there should always be an objective that you can win. You know you're going to get overwhelmed, but you can still win you can still claim a moral victory by claiming this objective. I would never want it to get to the point where players can't even claim a moral objective because the game is so overwhelmingly against that. But I guess I wouldn't be too concerned if it wasn't 100% balanced. It's somewhere between the two there, I think.
Is that the sort of approach you went when you were designing the unbalanced scenarios? For example,
yes.
There's the baggage train one, which is one of my favorites, which is it doesn't matter what you do as long as you get the correct number of baggage trains off the board.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, it doesn't matter how much you kill.
Mm-hmm. Exactly,
so
yes.
How would you go about designing something like that?
Well, you've got to come up with an idea for the scenario. First of all, it has to be a scenario. It has to be a battle which might not necessarily be the most cinematic battle ever, but there's a clear objective that one side is trying to get. But then, from a game design perspective, you've got to try and balance based on the objective rather than balance based on the armies, if you see the difference there. So normally in a pitched battle, you've got two equal armies, they've got an equal chance of winning. Well, for a narrative scenario, I would say that the balance doesn't come from the armies being equal. It comes from both players having a similar chance of achieving a winning objective, even if the armies are not equal.
Those objectives have to be different as well, don't they? In a competitive game, people tend to have the same objectives on either side, or it's I've got to kill more than you or something like that. One of the best ones that we played that would create all kinds of different stories was the defense of the idol, which was that the attacker is coming to the victory conditions for the attacker is you have to destroy the idol, and the defender has to defend for long enough that the idol is not destroyed. And this is very, very doable, but at the same time, it can swing hugely in favor of one side or the other. But it always, in my experience, came down to a really close game in which the attacker was one shot away from taking, you know, causing another nerve check with 10 wounds on the idol and destroying the whole thing. And in we used to play these in part of the map campaign. So you had an interesting tension, which was you could win as the defender because your idol wasn't destroyed, but at the same time, you might have lost your entire army as a result. So technically you'd win and you would defend the territory, but when you rolled at the end of the battle to see whether your guys died, you had to roll for every unit.
Yeah.
So that then had a real knock-on effect to the campaign as a whole and was somewhat of a Pyrrhic victory, but it would always create really good games. So I just have to thank you for that one.
Oh, you're most welcome. I'm really glad that they're getting played. I think Mark touched on it early in the recording that this book has kind of fallen off the radar a bit. So it's great to know that people are still playing the scenarios and enjoying them.
Well, and that's part of why we're doing this shout out basically for Destiny of Kings to get it back on the radar, because it is still available at Mantic Digital, and this thing is a treasure trove of information. So we really encourage everybody to come check it out.
Absolutely, and the combination of this Destiny of Kings and Nick's recent invention that we'll be talking about shortly, I think will be a real winner.
Absolutely. So, and I hate to digress back into Warhammer, but another thing that they had back then, and Nick, I would love to see you design this. So it doesn't have to be an app, but they had like this app or something that you downloaded, and you had two different armies that you put together. And then you would say, my army is moving forward. And the other guy would say, my army is flanking. And based on what maneuvers the armies were doing, it generated a scenario and a story that kind of worked its way through it. And I never downloaded it, but a friend of mine did. And I only got to look at it. And it was really cool. So I don't know if anybody has one of those or they want to chime in. But
it's funny you should say that, Mark, because I was looking at Iron Watch magazine not so long ago, the latest issue, which is out now, and a chap called Jack Dluhy, I think it is, has come up with a thing called Warscribe, which is a software app that will enable bookkeeping and visualization for map-based campaigns. So if you don't have a copy of, I don't know, Mighty Empires or any other tile-based thing, you can create a map in this app, apparently. I don't know that much about it. But apparently there is a fog of war mechanism which allows players to not really know what other players are doing and encounter them in a kind of quite realistic way and add greater immersion. And apparently will be available to work with any game system. It's currently on Kickstarter, apparently, and there is a version that you can try out. So, yeah, that seems interesting to me because I think that would probably really help campaign organizers.
Oh, that's awesome. We'll have to get Jack on the show. So I did play a game. It was a computer game, and this was 25 years ago or something. It was a long time ago. Man, it was longer than that because I wasn't even married, so it had to be 27-plus years ago. And it was really cool, but we would go to a party, everybody's drinking, having a good time, and then when your turn was up, you go into the other room, and there was this computer, and everybody had little kingdoms set up. And then you would go in, you give the thing for your armies and stuff. And then if you ran into another army, you battled it. And the computer battled it. The other player didn't. And you only saw what your units could see. So you couldn't find people on this map-based campaign. And when you were done, you'd hit next, go into the other room, grab a beer. Next person would go in, tap, tap, tap. And we would just play this game while I can't even remember the name of it. It was so long ago, and we had such a blast with it. That would be another awesome map-based slash narrative thing that could be done. So, but with the genius of Nick Williams, I'm sure we can get something out of
That game
him.
wasn't a Civilization, was it?
I don't
No.
think so. I really don't think so. I'm gonna have to ask some of my friends. I can't remember. This was so long ago. So, but it was really awesome. So, but I, again, segueing back to how I started this was that, my army flanks, my army advances, tick, tick, tick. This is what it is. And I'm sure there was a lot of elaborate stuff in the back end of it that made all the selections, but that would be an awesome thing to do. So, I don't think we have the budget to do a big app and all that stuff, but if we could do that on paper, Nick, you were talking about doing more narrative stuff this year, so maybe we could pitch that to Mantic and make that a
I
reality by
will
the
add
end of
that
the
to the
year.
list.
Well, I think what most people want when they indulge in a map-based campaign is they really want to immerse themselves in and imagine what it might be like to do it in reality. So what would it be like to be, say, Napoleon marshaling various armies through a landscape? And if you're just able to kind of go, well, I'm going to attack Bob today, or I'm going to attack Phil today, that doesn't quite give it that same verisimilitude. Whereas this app, if it doesn't allow you to know what other players are around and you're just progressing and feeling your way around, I think that will create, a real sense of immersion for players. And that's kind of what you want when you're playing a campaign.
I guess it would also have those big oh no units when you seem to stumble across and pick a fight with someone who's extremely good. He's oh dear, that's I didn't want to do that.
Strategic withdrawal, strategic withdrawal.
And speaking of resources that were in Ironwatch magazine, you found something else in there,
There's a
right?
nice little article just before the article about Warscribe, which is The Beginner's Guide for Narrative Wargaming by a guy called James Caron, which is, it's quite interesting because some people, I think, perhaps the idea of narrative wargaming, it doesn't come easy to them, and yet they still want to do it. And so he provides them with some ways in which you can create background and create names and create fluff for your units using a sort of randomized system and rolling a few dice, which is a little bit like back in the day, you had a sort of chaos name generator if you wanted to name one of your Warhammer Chaos people, and you would roll up one bit of the name and then the next bit and the next bit, and then you would end up with, I don't know, rot breath pus eater or whatever it was. And it seems to be a similar principle to that. So for people who perhaps, can't think of names and fluff very readily, that might be quite good for them.
Do you know which issue that's in? Because obviously I'd be
Oh,
interested in quite in that.
gosh. I think it's either 62 or 63 that's out at the moment. It is
Okay.
definitely, it was the current issue anyway.
Yeah, that's right. It's the current issue. So, and you're right. It's 62 or 63. It's got the who is that on the cover? What do you think that is, Daniel? Like a
I think so,
Vassalan
some sort of angelic
sister?
thingy.
That's issue
Yeah.
62 according to the website. So, 62.
Should be in there. Should be in there. Also, some pictures of my miniatures in there as well, for you to admire.
There you go. Check out Daniel's an awesome painter. So you do have to check out his minis that are in there. That's one of the nice things about our friends over at Ironwatch magazine. So
Yep, support them. Support them.
absolutely. If you've got some really awesome minis, take some pictures and send them to you might get published.
Absolutely, they accept all kinds of submissions. I'd submitted a few rubbish photos and they published those, so it's all good.
All right. Well, we've been running for a while on Destiny of Kings, and we've been teasing the heck out of you guys about Nick's latest creation. So, why don't we go ahead and slide into a commercial break? We're going to come back on the other side and turn the show over to Nick Williams, and he can tell us what he has designed for us.
Guys, we need a bumper to share with the other Mantic podcasts. No swearing allowed. Oh, real professional. The Fourth of Snake is a UK-based Kings of War podcast presented by John.
I want to be an individual.
Dan. Nick.
Can I go to the toilet, please?
And Matt. You can find us on Facebook at OFFS and on Twitter at O4FootSnake. And you can find us on iTunes. That's 32 points of damage. Let's do a nerve check. Anything but snake eyes. Oh, for
I'm Grant Alexander from the Bexley Reapers, and you're listening to Countercharge.
And welcome back. All right, Nick, we have teased everybody for an hour. So why don't you go ahead and tell the Countercharge audience what you have designed.
So I should say that it wasn't originally my brainchild. What it is a deck of cards which essentially generates a random scenario for you, a random narrative scenario, and it gives you additional strategy cards that you can play at any time. And the way this came about is that Mantic had the original idea that they wanted to do a deck of narrative cards. And at the time, the Rules Committee were quite busy with the Clash of Kings 2018 book. So Mantic turned to me and said, hey, we've got this idea for a card system. Can you take the ball and run with it? I said, yep. Asked them sort of, what detail have you got done already? What sort of guidelines do you want? They said, come up with it yourself. We want a card system, but we want you to write this. Obviously, I had the background of writing the narrative scenarios and stuff for the Destiny of Kings, so I think that played into their decision to ask me to come on board. And the way that I've got this working is that there's three types of cards in the deck. You've got objective cards, conditions cards, and strategy cards. Now, your objective cards will list a primary and secondary objective, and at the start of the game, you draw two of them. You choose one of your cards and use that to be your primary objective, and the second card is your secondary objective. You reveal your primary objective straight away, so both players know, you know, what the other player's primary objective is straight away. But then for your secondary objective, you reveal it at the start of your fourth turn. So it's a little bit of a hidden scenario that in the first few turns, you're kind of in your head trying to complete this objective that your opponent doesn't know about. But then also from your opponent's perspective, they do get to know what the objective is halfway through the game, so they can start to react to that and perhaps try and deny you your secondary objective. The condition cards, you draw one and you apply that for the entire game. And these are things like weather effects. So there's one in there for fog, basically, which gives some penalties to ranged attacks. There's lightning storms, which can ground flyers. And these are just things which you know, the battlefield conditions that you have to take into account with your game. And the last ones, I think, are the really fun ones. These are the strategy cards. You get one strategy card for each complete 500 points in your army. So a 2,000-point army would have four strategy cards. And these are cards that you can play throughout the game. And the things like adding and subtracting one to nerve tests, giving a unit vicious for a turn, giving a free blade of slashing to a unit of your choice. I think these are going to be really, really big game changers in terms of what they add to the game.
That's great. Now, you've shared some of these cards with us, so why don't we go around and talk about each one of these cards and, you know, kind of give some thoughts on them. So I'm going to start because I love this one. It's Advanced Scouting. Play this card before either player deploys any units. Your opponents must immediately deploy an additional unit when they deploy their first one. How fun is that? that could make a lot of people think twice a little bit. I guess it makes the scrying gem. I mean, if you add that on top of that, how does that work, Nick?
Well, they would be. So it's the scrying gem. It's D3 units, isn't it? If I remember off the top of my head, right? So yep. It would be D3 plus one units.
Nice. Of course,
there you go. Boy, you could have your whole army.
Yeah, so you can force your opponent to deploy quite a lot of their army before you deploy anything.
With the strategy cards, of course, you get those. You draw those randomly, don't you? So you wouldn't necessarily know that you were getting that one, and yeah. Couldn't plan for it.
No, you couldn't plan for it, but it'd be a nice combo if you had both.
Absolutely, Daniel. You want to take
strategy
the next
card,
one?
Unstoppable. Play this card after routing an enemy unit, but before rolling to advance for your regroup. If that regroup brings you into contact with another enemy unit, then you may roll to attack that unit as if you charged it in the move phase. handy, just like being an individual or
overrunning. Exactly.
Could be very helpful in certain situations, and could, you know, I could anticipate that swinging a whole game, actually.
It could. You can imagine it swinging an entire flank. You know, if you block an enemy from hitting the flank of one of your main units, you think, oh, I've protected the flank of that big anchor unit that I've got there. But suddenly they take out the chaff unit that was protecting the flank, and then they play this unstoppable card. Your heart just skips a beat because, oh no, they're still going to be able to hit that flank.
And you can't plan for it. You know, you can't plan, you can't think, oh, he might have that one card in amongst a whole deck, therefore I'm going to not position individuals on flanks to do that. You know, you don't know it's going to come up.
Boy, your inner competitive gamer just screamed a little bit.
Yes, it did. That's when I was writing some of these cards, I was just, the part of me was saying, no, don't do that, don't do that, don't do that, don't do that. That's so... But then the other side of me was saying, no, this is exactly what I need to write for these cards. If my competitive side is saying, oh, that could change the game, then do you know what? That would probably make a good narrative card.
Do it.
All right, Nick, there's another strategy card.
Yeah, another strategy card. Spotter. Play this on one of your units before declaring a charge order. That unit can see over the top of other units with an equal height this turn. If your unit couldn't otherwise see the charge target, then the charge is hindered. So this is really good if your opponent blocks your unit from a charge by blocking their line of sight. So if you've got a cavalry unit that's about to hit their flank, well, they position another height 2 unit in front of yours, thinking, oh, well, they can't see anything, therefore they can't charge. And then suddenly you say, oh, you got this spotter card, and I can actually see over the top of that blocking unit, and I can still pull that charge off.
Now, does this apply just to units, or can you use that for terrain?
The card that I've got here says units, but I think that may have been amended to units and terrain in the final print version. I'm not 100% sure on that one, but certainly the card at the moment just says units.
I thought I would get that one out just so it was epic.
Well, it specifically says units on the version that we've got in front of us, but I did pull it from a pre-final print version.
So presumably that might be quite useful for dwarven infantry if they're deployed in depth, to be able to double charge another height 1 infantry unit. Would that be right?
Exactly. You can use it to do those combo charges.
Fantastic.
That is fantastic. So now another type of card is a condition card. So let's see, the one I have here, and I love this one. I'm so lucky, Nick. I got two of the cards that I really love to talk about here. This one is Scouting Failure. Okay. Armies must deploy more than 9 inches from the center line instead of the usual 12. Love it. Boy, I can see the goblin players with 23 drops having an issue with that.
Well, this lets you start really close to the enemy. So it puts some units within charge range at the start of the game. If you've got a speed 10 units and you both deploy, you know, not just over 9 inches away from the center line, then suddenly, oh, you got turn 1 charges going off. But of course, you can deploy a bit further back from the line. You don't have to deploy at the 9-inch line. It just means that your engagements are going to come thick and fast in that game.
Can you imagine 23 drops of goblins? That close? It'd
be quite worrying.
Orcs by life as well.
Oh, unbelievable. Yeah, how much fun is that? So, all right, Daniel, why don't you go ahead and read
this
next
card. This is an objective
card,
the primary objective. 3 victory points if you hold the base objective on your opponent's half of the board, or 2 victory points if you hold or contest the base objective on your half of the board. Then there's the secondary objective, which is 2 victory points if you have more unit strength on the opposing half of the board than your opponent.
So I should clarify that when you're setting up the board for these cards, you place 5 objectives on the board, 5 objective markers on the board. You place 3 towards the center, 3 near the center line, and 1 on each half of the board. So what this is saying is that if you hold the objective marker on your opponent's half of the board, you get 3 victory points. If you hold the objective marker on your own half of the board, or you contest it, then you get 2 victory points.
I can see that being quite useful for certain armies, like dwarves again, he said. Notice the dwarf player speaking up. for getting victory points for kind of being a bit more static and holding your own side's points. But then at the same time, I see a possibility here that if you went for the first primary objective and you went for that same secondary objective on that card, you're basically getting over into the opponent's half, and they've really got to stop you, otherwise you are getting 5 victory points.
Yes. So each of the primary objectives is worth a maximum of 5 victory points in these cards, and then the secondary objectives are always worth 2 victory points.
It seems to be like a huge number of wonderful combinations, considering that you're choosing between 2 cards plus 2 objectives on each card. The combination yes. of that is going to take a while for everyone to work out, isn't it? You know, it's going to be a lot of exploration that we can do on that and have fun doing.
Absolutely. I think there's 12 objective cards.
Fantastic.
So however many combinations there are of those.
That's a lot of combinations.
There is.
There is, and that also leaves room for expansion.
Yeah, absolutely. I was going to mention it later on, but certainly I think if these cards do well, then there's certainly room for a second deck of cards to be produced as well, if they're popular. And I would also love to see Mantic do a deck of blank cards so that you could write your own.
Yeah, make up your own. That's
yes.
Perfect.
And the other card that we're gonna preview today is a condition card. So this is one of the ones where you draw one card for the entire game, and it's got special rules which affect everybody for that game. And this condition card is Boggy Ground. All speed stats are reduced by 2 to a minimum of 4 while carrying out an at the double or charge order.
How do you like that
card?
Go
dwarves, go dwarves. That's my response to that. Yeah, I'd be very happy if that card came up.
So these condition cards, they can affect some armies more than others. One of the games that I played, we drew a card which affected shooting, so that would, you know, make shooting-based armies have a bit of a tougher game. This will make fast armies have a bit of a tougher game because their charge ranges are reduced quite significantly.
Absolutely. So, but, you know, one of the ideas for future expansion decks is having them based on regions or something like that, you know, like a desert deck or a mountainous deck, or, you know, or make that an Ophidia deck or, you know, something like that for different battlefield conditions would be great. I can see that would be awesome.
Yeah, that would be cool.
Yeah, that would be awesome.
Absolutely. So now we're going to be able to get these cards this month, right, Nick?
Yes, I think they're actually released tomorrow officially. I should know that, shouldn't I?
Yes, I think they are coming out on January 22nd, I believe.
Let me just double check that. Yes, January 22nd, they come out.
I've got my fingers crossed mine are arriving tomorrow. And I'll be mugging the postman, if necessary, to get them. Plus my Clash of Kings 18 book.
Well, sadly, I'll be waiting for mine because, you know, I have Todd and Cindy sending them to me from Wartime Hobbies. So they'll be coming. I'm going to have to wait. I'm going to have to see all the pictures all over the internet. But fortunately, I'm a patient guy. But I am so looking forward to using these with Colin because I've been modifying, you know, kind of like the open war decks and stuff that the Evil Empire put out. But this is specifically Kings of War and specifically cool. So I'm very, 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 very excited about it. And this will lend a lot of spice for us because, you know, I mean, you've got the scenarios and you play through them. And I keep tournament scenarios and I keep like the International Campaign Day scenarios around for us to play. But talk about fun, fast, and furious, you know. You know, we try to knock out a game real quick, and these will be perfect. Downstairs, snap, snap, snap with the cards, boom, 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 knock the game out, you're done. You know, and if he wants to write stories behind them and, you know, develop everything, that would be cool. Or you could actually use these ideas and actually, as you kind of mentioned before, Daniel, pre-select the cards and design your own scenarios with them too. You know,
well, the condition cards are perfect for that, and they're perfect for creating a narrative account of the game. They're just adding that extra color that the whole game was on boggy ground, or, you know, it was foggy or whatever. It just gives you that extra thing to put into your story or put into your campaign. I think these are incredibly exciting, and I think they really do throw the gameplay up in the air, because it's incredibly satisfying to know that you've got a sort of a tactical box of tricks that you can break out, and it really helps with that whole kind of Kings of War being the tactics, victory being reliant on the tactics that you play on the table, not the army that you bought or the list that you made beforehand, because these cards can equalize or, you know, upset the balance a little bit once you're playing, which I think is brilliant.
Absolutely, I completely agree with that. And for me, I can't wait for them to be released as well, because I can't wait to get more games in. You know, we were play testing them and they're really, really fun games. One side which we've not really discussed in too much detail is kind of the cards play back and forth with the strategy cards. You know, so obviously a very simple, example, but there were times when it was a key combat that could turn the game around, and someone plays the plus one nerve test. You're like, yes, made the nerve roll. Then their opponent suddenly plays a minus one nerve test as well. No!
Yes, I think that's just adding an extra thrill to your games, isn't it, really? I play Warlord Games' Doctor Who game, which is very... It's a skirmish game, but it's got a lot of card-based things in it. And you get a lot of that going on. If someone doubles the damage and then you've got a card that halves it back down again, and then they play another additional damage and... You know, and then play. You're playing these cards, and it's just giving that extra element to moving the minis around. You know, it's almost like a game within a game, because you had, you know, the old Warhammer used to have the magic phase, didn't it? Which was a whole game within a game, which is a whole, you know, used to make games immensely long. But something like this just adds that on a taster of that, doesn't it?
Absolutely. And there's also the bluffing aspect, where your opponent thinks, "Oh, does he have that card? Does he have that card?" And you're holding a card up, waiting for them to say something. And it turns out you're bluffing. You don't have the card to cancel the one that they just put down. And, oh!
Yeah, it's like poker. And also with the objectives, isn't it? You can think, oh, has he got that secondary objective because he's heading over here? And
yes.
He might not have that one. He might have a different one, and he might be heading over there for a completely different reason.
Yes, exactly.
All right, so some are kind of interrupts, and some are play whenever.
Yeah, absolutely. There are ones that you can play specific times. So the advanced scouting card that we previewed, that one says play this card before either player deploys any units. But then the plus one nerve cards, the plus one or minus one nerve cards, can be played at any time.
With the strategy cards, are there one of each type?
There are duplicates of some.
Right.
So there's duplicates of the nerve ones.
Yep.
They're relatively common, but most of them are just one card.
Sure. So there is an element that you can't do that sort of card counting of I've got this card, therefore he can't have that card.
Well, if you draw from two separate decks, you can't do that anyway.
No, that's a good point. Use two decks. Excellent.
Yes.
Cool.
That is even better. That's a nice twist too. Thank you, Nick. Yeah, have two different. That definitely increases the card count, because I was just thinking the same thing. It's like, wow, is this okay? Yeah, but that's great. And everybody should have, I mean, how many opportunities do you get to carry the mind of Nick Williams in your back pocket, right? And bring him to every game. So, but it's just so awesome. So these, I can't wait for these cards to arrive. They're really going to add something to the games, and I really hope that we get some expansion packs and things like that.
Yeah, I can't wait to see people playing with them and seeing the games come out, and people sort of describing all the incredible scenarios that came out of them.
All right, Nick, anything else we need to talk about on the cards?
I think we've covered them quite well there.
Fantastic. Why don't we go ahead and slide into our final commercial break? We'll come back on the other side and we'll wrap up the show.
Join your hosts, Jake and Greg, as they cover the world's most exciting fantasy miniature game, Kings of War. On the world's most exciting fantasy miniatures podcast, Unplugged Radio. Talk background, miniatures, tactics, and more. That's Unplugged Radio. Find us on iTunes or on our website, unpluggedradio.com. Just replace the G's with 3's. And keep counter charging.
Hello, I am Daniel King, and I am the true one and only King of Texas, the Lord of Lone Wolf, and you are listening to Countercharge.
And welcome back. Well, I hope you've enjoyed this third episode of the Narrative Workshop, and a big thank you to our special guest, Nick Williams, for joining us. Thank you so much, Nick. And Daniel, do you have any shout-outs before we go?
Yeah, as mentioned earlier, Southeast London Wargamers are running a Kings of War League, which will start in February. So if you're listening to this and you are based in London and you can make it down to Catford, we're a very friendly bunch and we accept all comers. And it's all skill levels from your mega competitive to people who haven't played very much. And then the other thing is the Bexley Reapers tournament, which is a one-day tournament which happens in July. Look for it on Facebook. Just type in Bexley Reapers and you should be able to find it.
And that tournament is sponsored by Countercharge. We are one of the sponsors of that. As a matter of fact, our good friend Grant Alexander just shot me a copy, a picture of one of the trophies. Looking awesome.
I am going with the specific objective of being right in the middle of the pack.
You know, actually, people speculate that winning the Countercharger is harder than coming in first.
You have to be very specific to win the Countercharger. You want to win first, you need to win. You just do as well as you can. But Countercharger, you need to be perfectly average.
You've got to hold back a little bit if you're too good, which won't be a problem for me.
Yeah, that award is specifically designed for making sure everyone is recognized. And I really enjoy people getting the Countercharger award. So that's a big thing. But Daniel, you're going to love these trophies. So I'm going to see if I can sneak you guys over a copy of it. Very, very nice. Very nice. So Grant reached out. He is getting a lot of sponsors. So if you can head over to that particular tournament, it looks like it's going to be fantastic. We helped sponsor it last year, but this year it's even got a name and everything. It's the Shroud of the Reaper, Dicing with Death. So he's got logo, everything this year, so it's going to be fantastic. So we'll be shipping over some Countercharge goodies and things like that for everybody, and it should be a lot of fun. All right, very good. Nick, any shout-outs?
Yeah, I just want to do a big thanks to all the playtesters and the people who helped proofread the cards and weigh in with their thoughts, in particular Elliot Morrish and Tom Robinson, who live not too far from me. We had a great evening of playing with these cards. And yeah, so big thanks to them. And the other shout-out I want to do is to the 4-Foot Snake tournament, a 4-Foot Snake thing, which is on the 3rd and 4th of February. We're actually, as far as we're aware, the first two-day Kings of War tournament in the UK, which has got full soft scoring. So we've got paint scoring and sportsmanship scoring in there as well. We've got some fantastic prizes on the way. We've got, for example, Rosemary & Co. They've sponsored the tournament and they've sent over a brush bouquet, which has got some incredible brushes in there, and that's the price for best painted there. We still got some tickets available. We'd add some quite limited spaces now, but if you just look up 4-Foot Snake, you've got the details on how to contact us there. It's 2 days, five laid-back games, and you even get to bring your own special Living Legend character for free, and that's based on each of the 4-Foot Snake hosts. That's going to be a really great, really great weekend, that.
There you go. Daniel, are you heading down for that 4-Foot Snake experience?
Well, it'll be heading up for me, technically.
Yes.
I don't know where you guys are over there.
I'm a stubborn lot. No, it sounds really good, actually. It sounds sounds like with the soft scores, that would be something that I would definitely possibly go for.
Awesome. Very good. So, all right. Well, why don't we let people know where we can find out more of the goings-on of Nick Williams. Where can people track you down across the interwebs, Nick?
Oh, the best place is on Facebook. There's a little bit of Twitter, but not too much. I'm on Twitter as at Daedleh, so at DAEDLEH. But mostly I post on Facebook in the Kings of War Fanatics group, And I've also got my blog, which I post to occasionally, and that's daedal.kingsofwarresource.com. If you look me up on Facebook, I've got various links to that on there.
Fantastic. And how can we track down the mind of Daniel Reed across the interwebs, Daniel?
Well, I don't do Twitter because that's the downfall of Western civilization, but I can be found in the wretched hive of scum and villainy that is Kings of War Fanatics, and also Countercharge page and things like that. I'm not backward in coming forward, posting pics of my miniatures because I need my ego boosted on a regular occasion. So, yeah, Facebook is the place.
There you go. I occasionally hit Facebook. I'm hitting it more and more often, but, you know, for me, you can find me on Twitter, the downfall of Western civilization, at ASLSKFan, which I do not look at very often anymore. I'm trying to get down to one Twitter account because I have a life. And the one that I enjoy taking a look at more is at CounterCharge15 on Twitter. So a lot of fun. Keep changing my little avatar over there. I got to quit doing that. But we have a good time over there and just have a lot of chat. So if you've got any questions for us, reach out to us across the interwebs. We really appreciate you joining us for this episode of the Narrative Workshop. And like I said, we'll be back in February with some more fun and exciting narrative action. And until next time,
keep countercharging.
Thanks for listening. And we'll see you next time on Countercharge. Please let us know what you thought of the show by emailing us at counterchargepodcast@gmail.com, on Twitter at countercharge15, or by posting on our episode thread on the discussion forum found on manticgames.com. If you enjoy the show, you can help others find out about it by leaving positive reviews on iTunes. Until next time, keep countercharging. Music is a composition of Kevin MacLeod and is licensed under Creative Commons.